So hi everyone, thanks for joining us. Welcome to another edition of Storage Unpacked podcast. We have another great vendor with us this week, continuing the talks that we've been doing around the disaggregation of storage. We have Josh Goldenhart from Accelero, who's Vice President of Product for those guys. So hello there, Josh.
Hi there, and thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure.
And as ever, I am joined by the wonderful Martin Glassborough.
Hi, Gavin, but no Chris today.
That's exactly the next bit I was going to get to. Chris has decided he can't join us, unfortunately, due to travel and work restrictions, but I'm sure we'll cope adequately without him. You never know, it might even be a little bit more entertaining.
Oh, I doubt that. Anyway, we can say where Chris is. He's at NetApp, learning all about NAS again.
Ah, you see, now with me being polite, that we weren't going to talk about it. Anyway, so... yeah, we'd said that we're going to talk a little bit more about disaggregation. It's part of the reason for having Accelero on. But as regular listeners know, this is becoming a bit of a theme. We're seeing a lot of change across the market. Some would argue this is due to the commoditization of storage. But there's people been talking about software-defined data centers for a very long time. But I think it's fair to say that right now we're starting to see a dramatic shift in the industry away from some of the large monolithic enterprise storage boxes that have been out there for years and into people looking at how can I leverage some of the latest and greatest technologies that are coming out there, some of the great pricing that's out there on the marketplace from some of the storage vendors, and couple that with software that not only gets the most performance from these devices, but also significantly reduces risk without throwing up some of the costs. So Accelero's name has been pushed around the marketplace for some time. We started to hear about them. So one of the first questions, Josh, is who is Accelero? How did they come to be? And what's your angle on the marketplace right now?
Sure. Thanks. So Accelero is a company that's about 3 years old. In fact, we're just about perfectly celebrating our just over 3 year anniversary of being an official corporation. And the division was basically long before NVMe over Fabric existed. It was simply when NVMe drives first came out and really describing what their capabilities would be, the advanced API, the ability to have low latency and much higher IOPS because of the differences in the API. Our three technical founders immediately tied that to RDMA, of which they were experts in doing distributed databases and some other products like that, distributed memory systems. So they immediately made the link that if you were to take advanced networking, advanced low latency networking, and tie it to the NVMe interface, you could access these devices remotely. And so what was born was this concept that let's go ahead and see if we can do that. And they did some prototype code. It worked and very quickly got financial backing, and the company was born with the idea that you could go ahead and take this at the time, what was upcoming NVMe technology, and instead of just using it as a direct attached storage, or even when you envision NVMe over Fabric as a transport, using these devices remotely, you're still using them on a one-to-one basis. The idea was to take this remote protocol, make it hyper-efficient, very high performance, and make it into a storage product. So basically, the company was born. We came out with our first limited release in July of 2016. We came out of stealth in March of this year, and we're happy to announce we've got our 1.2 version, which is a very nice, solid, well-received version that's in production at several customer sites.
So it's a software product, isn't it, Josh?
It is. It is a software-only product. We've resisted the urge to go over to hardware, and you guys hit it right on the head. I think what's really changed is not just that standardized hardware is out there, but in the past, when people have talked about software-defined storage, usually that's been a way to put a software product that does storage services on commodity or standard servers, and the focus was on being cheap, cheap and good enough. And the difference that we're seeing with us, and frankly some competitors as well, but especially with us, is that you can put our software on top of standard servers and you can get levels of performance that are far higher than anything you can buy on a proprietary platform these days.
Is that something that you heavily control? Do you have like an approved list of hardware that you know you work with and can gain benefit from? Or is it pretty open that customers can use any server platform?
So we're very open. The answer to your question is yes on all fronts. We do have a list of hardware and software compatibility that we maintain. However, it's a very open list. From a server basis, it's basically any x86 server. And you might even see announcements in the relative near future that's saying they could even support other processors besides x86. So it's basically almost any server platform, practically any NVMe storage vendor. And then while we stress NVMe because it's so optimized, we actually do support even SAS and SATA drives.
Cool. That's good. I was going to say, so how do you do this?
How do we? Well, I think we haven't actually described even what we do. So what we are is a software-defined storage product, which is a software block storage. It is dubbed Server SAN, and that is you have SAN functionality that's made by putting our software on a group of hosts, standardized hosts, a high-speed network, that network either being Ethernet or InfiniBand. And we allow you to pool NVMe across many hosts, up to thousands of hosts. And instead of treating all those NVMe drives as individual direct attached drives, it is one massive pool that you can go ahead and carve out logical volumes and attach those logical volumes to any host in the cluster. And the difference between us and other products is that when you use that logical volume, we preserve the performance characteristics of the underlying NVMe. So that is, we add very, very little overhead, practically none. The real number is about 5 microseconds, and people out there need to make sure they understand I'm saying microseconds and not milliseconds. So we're adding about 5 microseconds of overhead, and thus a logical volume on top of with the NVMesh product on top of standard servers performs at the same kind of bandwidth and latency as if it's a local NVMe drive, but you get the benefits of what you expect out of a SAN, at least basic functionality, and that is failover, multipath, RAID 1 or RAID 10 mirroring. Optionally, you can go without protection and do RAID 0 stripes, and you can just get very, very high performance at very, very low latencies. That's kind of the preamble. You ask, how do we do this?
Yeah.
That was more like, what do we do? This is accomplished by, again, a software-only platform, allowing you to choose your standard servers, your NVMe drives. And we install on the systems that are designated as targets, that is systems that have NVMe that they want to share, you install our target software. On systems that want to consume storage or logical volumes, you install our client software, or some folks may call that an initiator. And lastly, we have a management piece. And management is installed on at least one system. And if you want to make it redundant, it has to be at least 3 systems. But the management piece is a configuration database. It's monitoring. It's a GUI. It's really a RESTful interface that is accessed in different ways. But it is not in the data path. So basically, the 3 elements are very classic from a software architecture standpoint. It's a management plane, a control plane, and a data plane.
So from an operating system point of view, Josh, systems?
It's a ton of different operating systems. It's basically any Linux that you want. So, and it's all the Linuxes. So we do, all kidding aside, we support the enterprise releases such as Red Hat Enterprise Linux and its open source or pure open source partner, CentOS. With our 1.2 release, we're officially supporting Ubuntu 16.04, also supporting SLES. And, for the right customer, we can basically support almost any Linux. The dependency is really on the kernel and on the version of the RDMA drivers, which could be Mellanox OFED, or if you have a new enough kernel, it could be the RDMA drivers that are built into the kernel itself. So we've supported everything from a 2.6 kernel all the way through a 4.12 kernel. So it's really not an issue there.
So it's interesting you talk about, NVMe and the platform there. By the sound of things, you've got quite an open platform that goes across the storage industry. Why focus in on the NVMe space? Is there any particular technology that takes you down that path rather than looking at some of the more general purpose storage marketplace?
Definitely. So the unique thing about NVMe, of course, is it's an API definition of drives that are directly on the PCIe bus. So when we say NVMe and people talk about NVMe drives, really NVMe is a project that standardized access to what was already going on in the marketplace. If we go back in time a bit, we had Fusion IO, which was a PCIe flash device. And then we had Viridint, which was also a PCIe flash device. But the drivers for these were completely different. people recognized that having NAND directly on the PCIe bus was great. It was really close to the CPU. It reduced latency. You got massive throughput, very, very high IOPS. But without standardization, it was going to have trouble going forward. So NVMe came along and said, hey, let's do at least at first, a PCIe-attached NAND standardization process where we actually get rid of all the bottlenecks that are associated with SATA and even SCSI or SAS protocol. And once we standardize that, that frees the market for lots of competition. People differentiate in the features of their devices. And it got rid of some of the problems of drivers because Fusion IO, while a fantastic product, was known for the driver taking up a considerable amount of CPU on the systems. So what you get is the standardization of a very low latency, a high bandwidth, and very high IOP device by really making sure that the API was not just standard but optimized for accessing non-volatile memories. So now if you take my explanation there and you believe it, you don't want to make your software only usable on traditional technologies because then you're really bottlenecking it. You go back to what I briefly mentioned earlier, that it's nice to have software-defined storage if your goal is to say, I want to save money and I want to make it cheap and I want to go good enough performance. That's just fine. And there are products out there, both open source and commercial, that do that pretty well. But we really wanted to go ahead and fully exploit the potential of NVMe because as NVMe is installed on systems, people find out very quickly that once you put more than 2 to 4 NVMe drives in one server, they actually have so much performance, the local server can't consume it. It's just simply too much. I don't know what you guys use as a rule of thumb, but we use about 1 million IOPS per processor socket. It doesn't seem to matter the number of cores. It's that if you're writing a real application, one that's really doing something, not just a synthetic benchmark, it's very difficult to have a host, a dual socket host, consume more than 2 to 2.5 million IOPS. Software just hasn't evolved to be able to consume that. We're looking at drives from multiple vendors that can do 750 to 800,000 IOPS per device. So again, once you have passed somewhere between 2 and 4, you can't consume the IOPS. If you add more NVMe, even just for capacity, you are leaving tons of performance on the table. You've paid for an expensive resource that you're just getting more capacity, but you're not getting any more performance. So what you need to do with that, the logical solution, is to share it. Go ahead and share it out to other hosts so that you can have other hosts partake of some of that performance. But of course, to do that, you have to have a very efficient, low overhead protocol. You have to have a system that doesn't just allow for lots of hosts to use NVMe remotely because that just becomes what I call remote DAS. I actually refer to NVMe over Fabric as remote DAS. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
It's a transport. It'll let you access the media remotely very quickly. But what do you do when you can access 1,000 remote drives? It's not a storage solution. So we provide that storage solution. Our software becomes the glue that makes all these individual media elements, whether they're densely populated on a few hosts or spread over many, many hosts, we take all that and we make it into a storage system. And that's where we feel is the way the market is going. You talked about disaggregation. We do what we call logical disaggregation. You can physically disaggregate. So that is really put your storage in hosts separate from the compute nodes. But we also support logical disaggregation. And what I mean by that, it's part of the technology we have, very unlike other solutions out there on the market, is we don't use any CPU on the target systems. And what I mean by that is best given by an example. I can take open source software. I can even take, let's just use iSCSI. For free, I can put an iSCSI target on a server. And I can put iSCSI clients all around my network, and I could use even NVMe storage on that target system. If I wanted to even use RDMA, I could use a technology called ICER, which is iSCSI over RDMA. The difference is that as my clients increase their client load utilizing that remote storage, the server that has the storage on it will also experience an increase in CPU utilization. That is, the iSCSI or the ICER target that's providing the block storage itself will use a considerable amount of CPU. And with NVMe, what we find is there's so many IOPS available that to drive to its full potential, once you get into the millions, you're using the entire server just for doing storage services. And you have to provide an expensive CPU before Intel, you know, went into the silver, gold, tin, platinum, copper. I used to say that you need a 2699 processor, which is a top-end, about $3,500 processor from Intel, to really extract all the performance that you get with NVMe over Fabric or iSCSI, any of these protocols. Now, juxtapose that with our software. When you run our target software, and we've shown this in some of the demos on our site that are still posted in videos, we showed a very off-the-shelf standard Supermicro server doing 4.5 million random read 4K IOs, and the CPU load was at zero. Actually, it was at 0.06. So we don't need much CPU, if any, really. We use the CPU for rebuilding. We use it for some of the initial control protocol. But for data itself, we don't use any CPU on the target. And this was – that's logical disaggregation.
Cool. So, Josh, you were talking about CPU utilization and services, data services. So as well as providing block storage, what data services are you providing within the Accelero product?
It's a good question. So data services, most people are going to jump to thinking about data services that they're used to on things like all-flash arrays. And to be fair to ourselves, I'm going to describe to you what we have for data services, and we'll be admittedly a little light on what people think is data services. For the initial product, we focused on stability, very high performance, and ease of use. And so with that, some of the traditional data services will be coming as roadmap items. So for now, what we provide, and what's very unique about us, is we provide our data services in the client itself. The intelligence of our system is in the client. That is the block device. What looks like a block device on the client is actually an intelligent block device that underneath it is doing logical volume management. So it's actually, it understands the layout of logical volumes and how they're spread across remote machines. So it's doing the actual logical volume management itself, the placement of blocks. It's doing multipath. It is doing failover. And it's doing these things seamlessly so that you don't have to do any other configuration on a host. There's no multipath files you have to configure. There's nothing else there. It's centralized management. So the services we have today are fairly light, but of course we'll be adding over time things like a more heavy-duty erasure coding and the things that you're used to, such as thin provisioning and deduplication. So the foundation has been to put in the intelligence to understand exactly how blocks are laid out, where remote devices are, do communication directly without any centralized metadata lock manager, without any centralized really control plane control as handled directly between the clients and targets themselves. And with that, it's the foundation that we've built to, you know, have a much grander house later on.
So you talked about erasure coding. Is that your data protection technology, or are you using traditional RAID type schemas as well?
Again, the answer there is yes and no on both.
Okay.
I'll clarify. Today we support RAID 0, so striping across up to 128 different target hosts.
Yes, but RAID 0 is not really RAID, is it?
Exactly. No. And for protection, we do RAID 1 or RAID 10. Okay. So again, do a striped mirror across up to 128 hosts, and every host can have up to 60 drives. So you can do a rather immense RAID 10 volume that's protected against a failure of any one drive or any one host. But I know even when I say that, and I did say it specifically, any one drive or one host, people say, well, wait a minute, if you go that large, you may have two failures. And that's exactly why we'll be supporting a more traditional, it'll look kind of like RAID 6, at first in an 8+2 format, but it'll be flexible in the end. And the difference is with us is why I said yes and no to your question. We're not using whole drives. Whenever I say drive, we actually use extents of drives. That is partial pieces of drives. So if I have 10 drives across 5 hosts and I do a RAID 10 mirror across those hosts, And I use a little bit of each drive. Maybe I only create 100 or a 200 gigabyte volume. I'm using a very thin slice of each drive. And the rest of that drive can actually be used by other volumes. Our RAID protection and our volume layout is on a per volume basis. So we don't make traditional RAID sets. So if I say we're doing a RAID 8+2, it's not that I'm using 10 drives and only those 10 drives. I'm using capacity from at least 10 drives, and they can vary across different hosts.
Yeah, so that's fairly similar to what some of the stuff which we have seen in traditional storage arrays as well. Things it sounds very much like a micro RAID.
I'd say that's a good analogy.
Yeah.
And when you rebuild, there's the chance when you rebuild into spare capacity, you know, you may not simply just use one drive. You may use multiple drives if that's the only capacity you had. So it's fairly flexible, and you can still get very, very good rebuild speeds because of the speed of the NVMe devices we're talking about.
Yeah.
So just going back to, you talked about the features and that there's plans to add some of those in the future. I've got to ask the question, how much does that hold you back? And the reason I ask is I used to work for a hardware storage vendor that really believed in the features being provided by higher levels in the stack and being really focused around performance and reliability, particularly performance. And I'll be honest, you know, sometimes that hindered us a little bit, because whether people needed dedupe or not, whether people needed snapshot functions, whether people needed some of the higher level things, there was this mindset that had been ingrained in them by usually people wearing orange sneakers that they had to have some of this feature support. Does that cause you problems in the application marketplace that you're playing in?
To be truthful, of course it does. In some customers that come to us say that they want those features. But at the same time, we find that those same customers might not actually need the kind of performance we can offer. Or more to the point, they might not need the performance NVMe can offer. Yep. So you are right that we do get contacted sometimes by folks that are, I would say, have a more enterprise notion of storage. And they just can't believe we don't have those features. But at the same time, they're not looking for sub 100 microsecond response times.
Yeah, to qualify
looking for. Exactly. So, and we'd like to say, look, you know, Pure Storage, Extreme IO, to kind of give a nod to other folks out there, these are great products. They're easy to use. They're scalable within what they do. And I respect those products a lot. But if we're in a deal, and our competitor is Pure, for instance, one of us is in the wrong deal. We're just simply not the same kind of product.
Yep.
Now, if you have a customer that has already made the leap, they said, you know what, we couldn't find anything out there that met our performance needs, and we're putting flash directly in our servers, and we're deploying, utilizing flash in the servers. That's a customer that's probably an NVMesh or Accelero potential customer. And the reason is they've already made that leap. They've already said, you know what, I can't use centralized storage. I have to get the either bandwidth or latency that I can get by putting flash directly in the servers. But then in making that choice, they are forcing themselves to have storage islands to do copy in, copy out, or provide redundancy at a higher level in the application. And if you're a Facebook or Google or very, very large web property, and you have hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of developers, you can rewrite your application stack. But if you're, for instance, an Oracle customer, you can't just rewrite Oracle the way you want. Or even if you just use open source tools like MySQL, you get trapped into MySQL, Cassandra, the models that are put in place by the people that architected those products initially, three-way replication. And what we find is these folks don't get very high capacity utilization of these, again, expensive devices. Overall capacity utilization across a wide range of servers using local flash is somewhere in the 15 to 25% utilization rate. So we help them with or without redundancy get up to very, very high capacity utilization rates. And so it pays for our software. It more than pays for our software. Because if they can increase their capacity utilization from 25% to, you know, arbitrarily close to 100, they more than pay for our software, and they're getting much better utilization out of one of the most expensive resources they're purchasing for their servers.
So you mentioned around applications. It's a good segue. What kind of applications are you seeing your customers using? What's the big use cases for you guys?
But that's very easy since you've been talking to some of our competitors and others. You're going to get the same answer every time, right? You're going to get real-time analytics, very large databases, and machine learning. So I can give you those same ones. But so those really are good use cases. But what we're finding is it's also applicable for financial services. It's also applicable for multimedia, oddly enough. And I don't mean your run-of-the-mill television broadcast. But we have had a great interest in very large workflows, such as those that are initiated by having to edit 4K or even 8K video. Mm-hmm. And these, as you're probably aware, need massive bandwidth. But the difference that's interesting here is that they also need low latency. And this was honestly surprising to us as well. So when you think about high bandwidth, you don't usually think about low latency. Usually high bandwidth doesn't really care about latency that much. And when you think about low latency, you're thinking about small block IO. What was a surprise to us was when we had a media and entertainment customer come to us and say they needed both high bandwidth and low latency. And this was for post-production and visualization work and special effects. And if you can imagine an editor at a workstation trying to edit either 2K video in 3D or 4K video, and then they even had some 8K workflows. And if you think about some of these massive theme parks that have these huge video walls, imagine Times Square, things like this, the resolutions are so high. There are even some custom 10K workflows. And hopefully folks out there know that when you go from 2K video to 4K video, you're not doubling. You're actually quadrupling the amount of storage you need and the amount of bandwidth. The reason latency comes in is when you have an editor that's going back and forth between frames, it's a human being looking at these things. And latency becomes key because you get a lot of delay, similar to one of those cell phone conversations that folks have when you start to interrupt each other because the timing is just a little bit off. You end up missing things. So low latency is key. So we were able to show performance levels that met the needs of these very high bandwidth workflows at very, very low latency. And so we're seeing a lot of interest now pick up in media and entertainment. So things like transcoding farms, live editing, or a real-time playout to different editing rooms. So we're happy there. There's also real-time analytics such as intrusion detection is key. And sensor data. And what I mean by that is it's either cameras or it's almost Internet of Things data coming in, satellite ingest. These are the kind of things that are massive bandwidth. And if you get too much latency and things get backed up a bit, you may lose a transmission. So we're seeing some interest there in the kind of government. And then HPC space. We're seeing a lot of interest. We're going to be out at the supercomputing show. So you can find us in the Mellanox booth. There's a little plug there. But thank you.
No, you got to do it. You got to do it. Everybody's CMO always tells them to go do this stuff.
So, but the key is of course, in we're finding applicability in high-performance computing, things such as life sciences, genomics, on HPC and supercomputing, burst buffers. When you have a supercomputer and it's doing you're spending hundreds of million dollars potentially for compute, when these servers do something called a checkpoint to preserve their state so that when you have a crash, they can recover. When you're doing checkpointing, you're not doing computing. And oddly, when the government pays for or a large institution pays for a supercomputer, they want to use it for computing, not for storing the contents of RAM out to spinning disk drives. So oftentimes they need a very large space, very, very high bandwidth to burst out what's called a checkpoint. And then once the checkpoint is completed, the cluster can go back to computing. So we've actually won a bid in a supercomputer in Canada with a partner, Lenovo. We're very happy about that. And so we're seeing a lot of interest in burst buffer and HPC as well. So lots of use cases across the board. Back to your question, which was where are we being used? Basically, in every company, there's a niche. And I don't want to imply that we're just niche-y, but in every company, including very large banks, including places like Walmart, there's a place where they need very high performance, either analytics, throughput, very high IOPS, and every place has one of these use cases, and we're applicable in those use cases. So even in very large-scale databases, run-of-the-mill Oracle, I don't know that you need us, to tell you the truth. Yeah. But if you have Oracle databases that are 150 terabytes with individual tables being as large as 20 terabytes, we have a customer that has recently tested on us and just got amazing results and will be using us for Oracle Rack. So for that kind of database, it's perfectly applicable.
I think it's really interesting use, actually, Oracle One. With the way Oracle licensing goes around cores and sockets, and if you can actually devote all your core and socket to actually doing the database processing, then as opposed to trying to throw IO around the place, yeah, I can see there's some real value in that, actually.
Yeah, absolutely, especially if you have a database that doesn't parallelize as well as you'd like. It's going to be all down to latency. And if we can decrease latency, and as you said, or kind of implied, if you can decrease the number of cores and or the number of servers you need in a cluster to get even the same result, you're going to save a ton of licensing on Oracle licenses. So it can be a very compelling use case.
I want to take you back, Josh, to something you said right at the beginning about architectures you support. You say, like, obviously NVMe is your main use case, but you do also support SAS and SATA. So is there any thought about adding in some kind of tiering technology into your system so you could actually have a mixed?
It's absolutely being thought of. Today, you can, what's the marketing term? Manually tier. What I mean by that is we already support different classes of flash today, so that even within NVMe, you could tier between read-optimized, kind of middle-of-the-road, and then high-performance drives. And then you could add a SAS or SATA flash tier. Now, I should be careful. When I said SAS or SATA, I mean flash. We're not supporting spinning drives yet.
Yeah, I get that.
Though, technologically, there's not a really – it's just more a timing issue. But we're not supporting spinning yet. It's all flash. Now, we do support awareness of these drives so that when you do provision of volume, you can say, in effect, give me a high-performance volume, and it'll only come from the high-performance media. If you say, give me a read-optimized volume, we'll only select drives that are in the read-optimized. So we have a way for you to classify devices into these different classes you define yourself, and you can choose that. Now, once you have those, you could copy between them, and that's what I meant by manual tiering. Of course, this does lend itself exactly as you're implying. When we do have virtualized blocks, which will come with our thin provisioning we're hoping will be sometime next year, then we can implement a tiering and have automatic movement of data or via policy engine to go from one tier to another. In the meantime, we are integrating with file system products that can do this for you. And in a lot of ways, honestly, and this is almost a personal belief here, my philosophy has always been that the file system is in a much better position within the hierarchy of storage to make a decision on which blocks should be moved rather than the block layer itself.
So which file systems? I'm a bit of a file system geek, so I'm kind of interested in which file systems you're supporting.
IBM's Spectrum. Yeah. Yep. IBM's Spectrum Scale, formerly known as GPFS, is very popular with us. We actually, not by design, but I'd say 25-30% of our customers are running GPFS today, and there's we have a lot of integration points with that product, so we're happy with that file system. The StorNext file system, also, you know, a little, you know, some folks may say a little long in the tooth, but StorNext, especially in media and entertainment, also has some of these capabilities to be able to do data movement, so it's good there. And so these are both capable of moving things around. If you go ahead and put an object layer on top of us, you could also do the same. There are things that can do movement between object layer and file. So in a roundabout way, I've opened up the opportunity for myself to tell you about why we chose block. Block is under everything. If you implement object storage, it's on top of block almost always. It was either on top of a block and then on top of a file system, and now with optimizations it's on top of block. File systems are on top of block, so being block gives us the opportunity to really improve the thing that's at the very lowest level, and then everything else you build on top of that hopefully is faster. With that, we do believe that the selection of what to tier is best made at that kind of higher level, either the application level, the object layer, or the file system level. Yeah.
You talked there about partnerships from a software point of view, and you mentioned previously about partnering with Lenovo. Yep. So who are you working with from a hardware point of view? Is anybody you're going to market with? And I've got to ask the question about, you know, there was a lot of publicity about you guys with Micron. So we've got to cover the elephant in the room and ask, you know, what happened there?
So on hardware, you should look for some announcements of hardware partners, I'd say, in the next couple of days to weeks. One sooner in days and one in weeks. This will actually come around to the end of your question about the elephant in the room as well. Lenovo is a partner that we've not made a lot of noise about. We're very happy to work with them, and we've actually won, as I mentioned earlier, an HPC bid with them. So that was very good news. We do actively work with the other players that you'd imagine. I mean, if we're talking about the largest hardware companies in the world, there's very few who are providing servers at that scale, and we are working with all of them. What happened with Micron? Mm-hmm. If people looked at Micron very carefully at solid scale, they would see, if you're any fan of hardware, that these were super micro servers. And so they're super micro servers that Micron, as a vendor of media, was going to go ahead and make into a storage system. And then Micron had a change in management. The change in management came in and basically said, you know what, we're not sure we agree with those decisions, and we want to refocus our energies on media. And they made some changes. And so what we're certainly hoping is going to happen, Chris wrote about this, Chris Meller at the Register. He got some info, and I can't comment right now if it's 100% correct, but if you look at the fact that this was a super micro server, and of course still is, and there was a significant pipeline of customers, this platform is going to become a reference platform. You'll see the solid scale, what was a brand for Micron, instead of being sold by Micron and trying to be supported by Micron, it is still a super micro reference architecture that has customers behind it, and we will drive it to those customers, and you'll just see the things reappear, hopefully on the Micron site, but definitely on ours, as the solid scale reference architecture. And with that, you can imagine there are other folks in the world set up to resell super micro servers that are in a better position to do that with support.
Subtle.
And so it's, we're making, we're trying to make lemonade out of lemons, right? It's, is it a good thing that they, that the new management said, we don't want to go that way? No, it's not a good thing. But everybody is entitled to their opinion and experience, and we respect the decisions they made, and we really like the Micron products. The media itself is great. They have a good roadmap for their products. And in a lot of ways, this ends up working out because we do support all sorts of different NVMe vendors. And in a very weird way, it means that, there's not somebody that's more favored over anybody else.
From that, how do you go to market? Are you through channels? Do you sell directly to end users? And where are you geographically? Because, a lot of our listeners are all over the world, so I want to know where they can work with you guys.
Sure. Thanks. So we are based in the U.S. for sales and marketing out of the Silicon Valley in San Jose, California. So North America is really our prime market, although we are in EMEA as well. And we do have a presence in Germany. So we have some sales and support in Germany. We have sales, marketing, and support in the U.S. But we have had a sale or two in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. And some activity in China. So not to put too fine a point on it, we're a startup. So we're going to go where the money is. Now, we don't want to stretch ourselves too thin also. So there is, like I said, a focus on North America. And the answer to your question on how we go to market is we are a direct sales force, but we sell through partners. Okay. So it's even if we get a direct lead, we usually 99% of the time hand it to a partner. The reason I say 99%, it's not 100, is there are some larger customers who come to us and simply say, that's great. We cut out all costs wherever we can, and we're not going to, we don't want to suffer even a few points from a reseller, or we need a relationship with you because we're so big, it's going to be like dealing with an OEM.
Yep.
And so they have to have direct access to us. Other than that, it's 100% go through partners and channels. And we do have several partners. There's been some announcements. We're very happy to have out of the UK, Boston Limited is actually selling what looks like an appliance. Their Flash IO Talon system is based on Accelero NV Mesh. So you can go ahead and do a Google search on that one. And we have a couple other partners lined up. I think it's going to be an exciting time for announcing partners, if that is not an oxymoron, exciting time for announcing partners. You're going to be announcing from us for several partners in the upcoming weeks and months. So we have a fairly rich partner ecosystem, and we hope to keep expanding on that.
Cool. That's good. Martin, any more questions from you?
No, it sounds a very interesting product. I think it's been well described. And yeah, I think it's a really interesting market at the moment. I think there's so many different players in this market. It's going to be interesting to watch.
It is interesting. And to tell you the truth, it's interesting and we're relieved because, you know, a year ago even, we didn't have many competitors we could point to and say they're competitors. And now we do. And, you know, the problem with not having competitors is you have to sit and wonder, are you in the right space? Yeah. Did you do something that no one wants? Mm-hmm. And we're very happy now that there are folks out there. I will say, though, to toot our own horn, we still seem to be the only one that is software only.
And I'll go along with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's very much your USP, I think, with that you're software only at the moment.
Yeah, and it's not just that it's only software, it's that we can perform at the same rate or better than some of our competitors that are offering hardware. So it's an interesting time. We're happy to have the folks out there. We're happy that that people are picking up on it more, that coverage like this podcast is happening. So this has been a lot of fun and really it's really a good time in the market.
No, thank you for coming on. It's exactly what we're seeing. You know, there's a reason we're covering the disaggregation of storage. It's not just because it's something that the three of us particularly are interested in, but we're hearing a lot of feedback from our listeners. That's what they want to hear about and they're seeing in the marketplace. So, Josh, thank you for taking the time to come on. And Martin, thank you as ever. I'm just going to wrap up now and say, anybody else that's been listening, please keep subscribing to us. I know lots of people are downloading the podcasts and we're trying to get as many people to subscribe, whether that be on iOS or Android or whatever platform you're using. Please actually subscribe to the podcast because that gives us a better idea of who's listening to it. As usual, if you've got any questions, feel free to contact us on Twitter by direct message at Storage Unpacked. The email address is still live at info@storageunpacked.com. Or as usual, we've got a great LinkedIn group that no one can ever remember the profile for. But actually, I've got the URL in front of me, and it is group number 12012104.
I bet you can't. Wow. But you haven't learned it off by heart yet, though, again.
No, I haven't. I've got it on the page in front of me because no one ever remembers that. Why LinkedIn don't do great group numbers and names, I don't know. But again, thank you for listening and stay tuned. And we'll have another podcast with you pretty soon. But thanks again, Josh.
All right. Thanks, Mark and Gavin. It's been a pleasure.